A week after it first made landfall in Texas, Harvey is still causing heavy rains and some flooding today in Kentucky and Tennessee as it moves north and east. In Texas, people along the Gulf Coast are still struggling with the flooding and damage caused by Harvey. And we're joined now by NPR's John Burnett, who's been covering the storm and its aftermath all week. He's now in Austin. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with Beaumont, Texas, where people have been evacuated because the flooding caused a tap water outage. What's the latest in Beaumont?
Well, the mayor of Beaumont, Becky Adams, said yesterday, Beaumont is basically an island surrounded by water. As you said, the city water system has gone out. It was totally swamped. It's they have no water, no running water, no drinking water. Our reporter, Debbie Elliott, talked about people waiting for hours in line for jugs of water at supermarkets. The feds are now trying to establish water distribution centers in the city, bringing some big tanks in. Really distressing, the hospitals can run on emergency power, but they have to have water. Beaumont's major hospital, Baptist Beaumont Hospital, is evacuating 193 patients. So that's going on as we speak.
One of the big concerns yesterday was the Arkema chemical plant. There have been fires there. What do we know about what's going on there at this point?
Well, an Arkema exec said this morning to expect more fires and small explosions at that Crosby, Texas plant, which is outside of Houston. One container exploded and caught fire early Thursday and burned itself out, but there are an additional 8 trailers containing these unstable organic peroxides. They've evacuated about a 1.5-square-mile exclusion zone around the plant, and our science correspondent says it's more accurate to call the dark smoke coming from these fires noxious rather than toxic. These, as we know, the generators were supposed to keep the refrigeration going were swamped, and so the cooling went down and these chemicals became very unstable.
Not sure you'd want to be breathing in things described as noxious either. But what about Port Arthur, another town that's been dealing with a lot of flooding? Debbie Elliott tells us that it is still underwater. What more do we know about what's happening in Port Arthur?
Well, you know, it's in that what they call the Golden Triangle, the industrial triangle of Beaumont, Port Arthur, Orange. The Port Arthur mayor, Derek Freeman, posted on Facebook Wednesday that our city is underwater. Harvey has knocked out about a quarter of the nation's refining capacity, which is on the Gulf Coast. That includes in Port Arthur, Motiva Enterprises, the nation's largest refinery, and then really big refineries run by Valero and ExxonMobil. Could be weeks before they're back up. This has caused something of a panic in gas supplies. I don't know what you're seeing up there. But down here in Texas, I saw a line here in Austin with 12 cars waiting to get gas. And it's mainly due to rumors on social media. The authorities say there are ample fuel supplies and people, you know, shouldn't panic.
What about the rescue efforts that have been going on? You went out the other day with citizens rescuing people by boat in Houston. We've heard about helicopter rescues. Are those still going on in Texas?
You know, I talked to Nathan Rott, our correspondent in Houston this morning, and he says they're fewer and fewer. And that's because the water levels have been dropping in parts of Houston. When I drove back to Austin yesterday, you could see some underpasses that flooded on Sunday were dry on Thursday, although some of the big bayous like Buffalo Bayou are still cresting. So a lot of the helicopter rescues are going on farther east in Beaumont, Port Arthur now. But what's happened in Harris County is because the water level is receding in some places, that's allowed police and firefighters to go house to house to rescue stranded survivors and to look for bodies.
And a lot of people who did survive the storm are heading back to their homes for the first time. What are they finding?
Well, it's Hurricane Katrina all over again, Jeremy. They come home, they find a water line in their house, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet up the wall. The sheetrock is going to start to mold. Their furniture and their possessions are ruined. Their refrigerator has become these reeking boxes of rotting food. The studs that frame the house may or may not still be salvageable, so it may be a complete teardown. They may be able to rebuild. Most of them don't have flood insurance. The people of the Texas coast are going to need long-term temporary housing. Those FEMA trailers that became this hated emblem of Hurricane Katrina are long gone. And today, FEMA hopes to get people out of shelters and into transitional housing, such as hotels or mobile homes or rentals. But that's really all happening right now. We don't know, you know, how that's going to work out.
Well, it's a story that is going to continue for a long time, perhaps years into the future. John
Absolutely.
Burnett, NPR Southwest correspondent, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, another story we're watching today. President Trump is reportedly weighing his options on the Deferred Action of Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. That's the program that defers deportation for young adults who were brought to the U.S. as children inside a certain window. On the campaign trail, the president vowed to end it. Then after his election, he seemed to soften his position. In February, he said he would show great heart in dealing with the so-called Dreamers. But a group of 10 Republican attorneys general demand that he make good on his campaign promise by next Tuesday, or they'll expand a lawsuit on the matter. And the president's also facing pressure inside his administration. Here's Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, who vice chairs Donald Trump's Election Integrity Commission. He was on Fox and Friends this morning.
My advice to the president would be to end DACA right now. The legal question isn't even a close one. You've already had multiple courts say that a similar amnesty that came a few years after DACA was completely illegal. This one's illegal. It violates three different federal laws. It violates the United States Constitution. It's a loser.
Okay, well, there are also other voices inside the Republican Party who are calling for support for the Dreamers. Let's get the latest on the program and what might be happening from NPR White House correspondent Jeff Bennett. And Jeff, we're noticing that just within this time frame that we are here with you, President Trump is saying that he will make a decision on the Dreamers today or over the weekend. So first, remind us, how many Dreamers are there? What were the requirements? You know, tell us about this group of people.
There are close to about 800,000 young people who were brought to the country illegally as children. And as you mentioned, there's a number of criteria they have to meet. They have to have been brought here under the age of 16. They have to, when they apply, have to either be enrolled in or have graduated from high school or college. They can have a criminal background. They have to submit to a background check. They have to register with the Department of Homeland Security and pay some fees. And that then grants them, if they're approved, they then get these two-year renewable work permits and waivers that allow them to be shielded from deportation. And so the decision that the president could make, he could either decide to just revoke those work permits outright, which would then make all of these people targets for deportation, or he could in some way decide to, you know, gradually phase out the program.
Yeah, some are saying don't issue any new permits, but keep those for those who already have them. But we understand there are 800,000 of those work permits. People are saying that that would be 1,400 people a day who would be put out of work every single day. So what are the pros and cons?
Well, you know, the immigration advocates say that if DACA is to go away, it would send all of those people back into the shadows. In the course of the reporting that I'm doing on this, I actually spoke with a Dreamer who said that he was brought here by his mother, and he said he didn't really see a path for citizenship. He didn't qualify for family-sponsored immigration because his entire family was here illegally. He didn't qualify for the program for high-skilled workers. So for him, DACA really is all he has, and he feels as if that goes away, he would be an immediate target for deportation.
We'll talk about some of the voices within the president's own party who are saying either fix DACA, don't get rid of it, or as Arizona's Republican Senator Jeff Flake tweeted out today, protect the Dreamers.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this, Robin, because you have not just Jeff Flake, but Republican leaders like Paul Ryan, Senator Orrin Hatch, who are saying the very same thing. They do not want the president to end this program. What they want is a congressional fix. Now, obviously easier said than done. But one of the things that has been floated, particularly by the president, some of the president's advisors, is that he should in some way use these DACA protections as a bargaining chip to get Congress to fund his border wall, right? So the idea is that if Congress then enshrines DACA in law, then in exchange for that, they would pay for this long-promised wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The problem with that is that Democrats and many immigration advocates say that that whole option is dead on arrival because they first of all, don't want to pay for the wall, but they also don't want to be seen as pitting one group of immigrants against another.
Well, another thing that happened with DACA is that these young people came forward and identified themselves. So is there a fear, you know, among that community as well, that once they've done that, they're exposed?
Absolutely.
I mean, we should say why, because they have to re-up every 2 years in order to have.
That's right. And they have to go on record, submit all their information to the government, and not just about them, but about some of their family members, who, by the way, in often cases are undocumented. And so there's a real fear that, you know, they as the phrase they use, they came out of the shadows because they thought that they would have this promise of protection. And yet, without that safety net, they feel as if they'd be targets.
Yeah. NPR White House correspondent Jeff Bennett. Again, President Trump saying today that a decision on DACA from him will come either today or this weekend. He also said, we love the dreamers. We love everybody. We will continue to follow this story. Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Hurricane Harvey and its aftermath have brought out some of the best and the worst of social media. There's the Instagram post of Pastor Eric Harding gently playing the piano in his flooded living room. There's the Facebook post that shows Houston resident John Nash defending his store from looters. But the vulnerability of Texas residents trying to survive the storm is just, you know, also brought internet hoaxes ranging from fake pictures of a submerged airport to that shark swimming down the highway. On Friday, we look at the week through social media with Femi Okeh of Al Jazeera English. Let's do that. Femi, hello.
Hello, Robin.
And let's listen to a little of that pastor playing in his flooded room. You know, the water's up to the bench. You can hear the water. Tell me more about this.
This is Eric Harding. He went back to his flooded home on Wednesday to basically pick up some toys for his kids because they were out of their home. They evacuated earlier on in the week and his kids didn't have games and their favourite stuffed toys, so he picked them up. And he also wanted to show his son, who loves playing the piano, that the piano still played. So he got a friend of his to film him for Instagram playing the piano.
Mm. What are people saying?
Oh, Splash Forward, what an appropriate name, says on Instagram, "Oh, now you did it. You made me cry. You found beauty in ashes." And Jen Brown also commented, "This will be etched on my heart when I remember Harvey. Sorrow and hope." And Eric actually only has about 2,000 followers on Instagram, but this one post alone got over 14,000 comments. Actually, 2,000 followers on Instagram is quite a bit, but he got way more comments. And then also this video has been shared online, on various different media outlets as well, and it has really gone viral. It's such a beautiful video.
I mean, it just is. I mean, this has been an extraordinary storm in and of itself, but we've gotten to see it and see what it feels like to be in it because of social media. It's been amazing. By the way, anybody sending him a new piano?
Oh, wow. He's playing the piano because he's and he says, "I just want my son to know that the piano still plays." And he says, the pastor says, "I think it's finally sinking in a little. What we used to have as a city is gone." So people then started to say, "Hey, pastor, do you need a new piano?" One particular tweet came in yesterday, and that was from the singer Vanessa Carlton. And she says, "I'd like to get him a replacement piano if this one doesn't make it." So you can actually direct message him at Eric Harding, that's Eric with a C, Harding on Instagram. I'm sure he'd be delighted to hear from you. Also follow him because you can see how he and his community are recovering from Harvey and all of the flooding.
Well, we're thinking down the road, he's probably going to get a piano, but there may be hundreds of other people that will need one. So maybe that becomes, you know, a bigger movement to get musical instruments down to the area. There's the Facebook post from Nash John in Houston. He's in front of his grocery store carrying his shotgun, scaring away looters. Let's listen.
They looting the stores, and this man out here is trying to literally protect the community because he's saying the storm is
on. I still support law enforcement. Those that do right.
Okay, well, how are people reacting to that?
So what you see on the video is Nash John. It's a little grocery store. It's a car lot. And the lady you heard on that tape was Tay Mabry, who saw Nash John with a shotgun slung over his shoulder, watching looters looting this little grocery store. And he's just yelling at them, "You better get out. This is where we live. We need more real men out here to step up to protect where we live." And the looters saw Nash with his gun and ran off. Reaction: that's a bleeping hero. Fill in the bleep. Is this this, and also Tay Mabry, as she was commenting and shooting this video on Facebook, said, this is the sort of news that mainstream news outlets aren't showing you. And I think this is the gap, Robin, and you mentioned this. We're getting so much more insight into what's happening around Harvey, the recovery, the flooding, because people are posting their experiences, their stories. Yeah.
Look, there's also been an uproar over a beautiful photograph of a male rescuer carrying a woman who was cradling her baby through these high waters. The picture went viral. But then conservative blogger Matt Walsh tweeted out, "Woman cradles and protects child. Man carries and protects both. This is how it ought to be. Despite what your gender studies professor says," well, a gender studies professor weighed in.
Absolutely. Her name was Christina Wolbrecht, and she says, "I couldn't resist responding." And then we have an epic Twitter debate. The thread goes on
forever.
11. I'm not going to do all 11. Let me just tell you the one of the points that she was making in her thread. "We love to laud a woman cradling her child, but don't provide paid maternity leave." Comment number 10. "In sum, your rigid and illogical sexual division of labour and related hierarchy of value hurts both men and women." Multiple comments on this. And then the internet weighed in with some pictures. And the pictures were maybe just readdressing this idea of what should be an appropriate gender balance. We have a raccoon carrying a cat, a rat riding a cat, riding a dog. And Gabriella says, "This is how it ought to be, despite what your gender studies professor says." And then, of course, the Michael Jackson gold statue with him hugging his monkey. That is how we should divide our labor.
All right.
So there's some humor there, yeah, but also a very fierce gender studies debate.
I want to say that the shark in the streets was a hoax, from Dublin. And also there are very serious fake websites for collecting money and everything. So be very careful of the fake rumors that are there as well. Femi, okay.
Oops. Absolutely. And online, just easy to avoid the hoaxes is just follow your trusted news source.
Right. Femi Oke at NPR. Femi Oke from Al Jazeera English. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
We have the Labor Day weekend ahead. Some of us are lucky enough to not be in the flood area, maybe celebrating, maybe with some ice cream. Did you know that vanilla comes from the bean of a specific orchard? And most of the world's supply of vanilla comes from Madagascar, but there's a shortage, they're expensive, and that wouldn't have been a big problem a few years ago when many companies relied on synthetic vanilla flavor. Irina Jarov of WHYY's The Pulse reports that customer demand for all things natural is driving vanilla prices, including your ice cream, and changes in the flavor industry.
Teresa Wall owns Tarte's Pastry Shop in Philadelphia. In her tiny pink bakery, she's preparing cannelés, French pastries flavored with rum and vanilla.
These are the vanilla beans. Right now I just split the pea pod, the vanilla bean, in half and am scraping out the seeds. And you know, you always try and get all of them because they are expensive.
She whisks the vanilla beans in a pot of heating milk to break them up. She then cracks eggs into flour and sugar and pours the hot milk into the flour batter.
That smells so good.
Yeah, it does.
What percentage of what you make would you say actually uses vanilla?
Oh, I would say at least 75% of what we make has vanilla in it.
Wall uses real vanilla beans, but there's currently a global shortage. Just 8 years ago, a kilo of vanilla sold for a low $25, and many farmers in Madagascar gave up on vanilla plantations, reducing harvests. A recent cyclone destroyed about a fifth of the limited crops. Meanwhile, demand has gone up, further tightening supply. This year, a kilo of vanilla beans has been selling for around $500. But 99% of the vanilla we eat is not the real stuff Teresa Wall uses. Scientists figured out how to isolate the main chemical of vanilla, called vanillin, in a lab to make vanilla flavor. Nadia Berenstein, a flavor historian, says vanilla flavor was first made in Germany in the 1870s.
Two chemical researchers figured out how to synthesize it from a compound called coniferin, which is basically found in the sap of different kinds of evergreens.
Over the years, scientists have produced vanillin from coal tar, wood bark, paper pulp, clove oil, and from fossil fuels. Whatever the source, vanillin is vanillin.
a chemist will tell you that they're identical.
On a box of cookies or a carton of ice cream, though, flavor labeling gets complicated. If the vanilla flavor comes from spices, botanicals, fruits, or vegetables, it's labeled as natural vanilla flavor. Most of our vanilla flavor today comes from petrochemicals, which has to be labeled as an artificial flavor. Lately, companies like Hershey's and Nestle are vowing to stick with natural flavors. Consumers demand it. The problem? Not only is there not enough vanilla bean, there's not enough of natural vanilla flavor to go around. So, some companies are exploring new methods to make the flavor. Christina Agapakis works for one. She's the creative director at Ginkgo Bioworks, which makes sense in flavors.
We know a lot about the enzymes responsible for producing flavors in plants.
The company takes flavor-making mechanisms from plants and puts them in a yeast. Feed the yeast a little sugar, and voila, it pumps out your desired flavor. They're attempting to make vanilla flavor this way. And if they succeed, will it be natural?
I like to think of it as a third category. It's a biological flavor. It's a cultured ingredient. I think the distinctions that we draw between natural and artificial are themselves pretty artificial. There's a lot of nuance.
Back at her Philly bakery, Teresa Wall's cannolis are done.
Just like Oreos, I have certain ways. I always eat the top first. It's super crispy because all of the vanilla seeds are sitting up there at the top, and then you get this like really intense flavor, and that's probably my favorite part.
Wall says she grew up on real vanilla and prefers it. Regardless of advances in the science of flavor, she'll keep using the real thing. For Here and Now, I'm Irina Zhurov.
For many years, the University of Illinois has been at the center of the debate over symbols or mascots seen as demeaning to Native Americans. At Illinois, this debate involved the chief, a figure dressed in buckskin who performed at the school's football and basketball games. The chief is no longer the school's mascot. And this week, there was another development in the controversy involving this. University officials have decided the school band, the Marching Illini, will no longer play the so-called war chant at sporting events like tomorrow's season-opening football game. Joining us now is Brian Moline from member station WILL in Urbana. Brian, tell us more about this. Who made this decision and why?
Well, this seems to be a joint decision made by university administration and by athletic department officials. It was kind of a strange rollout on this, Jeremy. It started to spread on social media about a week ago after a student group that was playing the war chant at a soccer game was told to stop by athletic department officials. The next day, athletic department spokesman Kent Brown confirmed that the university would no longer use the war chant during athletic events. And then athletic director Josh Whitman released an open letter to fans about the decision the next day.
And is this because the war chant is seen as racist?
It is seen as definitely insensitive to Native American culture, I would say, Jeremy. And it really goes back to the university's ongoing issues with the retired Chief Illiniwek. They retired Chief Illiniwek as their university mascot or symbol in 2007. After about 20 years of protests from various members of the Native American community and the campus community here at the university, but the some of the music still associated with the chief had been still used at athletic department events, and really there is still some music that the Marching Illini will play during their halftime show that is still associated with Chief Illiniwek.
And this has been a very controversial issue. I mean, I'm a native of Urbana. I know this from my whole life. People either big time pro chief or big time anti chief at the games. And in fact, if you go to a basketball game now, you'll still see people wearing T-shirts with the chief on it, even though the official logo now is just like an eye, right? What is the reaction to this latest decision by the university to end the war chant?
Well, as you might expect, Jeremy, it is still a controversial issue here in Champaign-Urbana. There are critics of the chief who are very happy about that decision, including University of Illinois professor Jay Rosenstein, who actually made a documentary called In Whose Honor about 20 years ago that really, I think, kind of put into words and pictures a lot of the anti-chief sentiment around campus. And there are longtime Illini fans who are upset by the decision as well. There's been a lot of conversation on social media on both sides of this.
And is this the end of the debate now?
By no means. There is still a music known as the 3-in-1, which actually the Marching Illini have been playing since before Chief Illiniwek even started performing back in the 1920s. That music will still continue, and the athletic department says there's no interest in ending the use of that music here at the university.
That's Brian Moline, host of Morning Edition on WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Brian, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Fort Bend County Sheriff's Office tweeted out pictures of native alligators on people's porches with the tag, "Leave alone till water recedes." Then there are the 350 rescued gators at Gator Country in Beaumont, Texas. The owner worries they'll wiggle out as waters rise. Then there's the waste. Houston is negotiating an EPA consent decree that requires the city to upgrade its water and sewage system, which has historically backed up. And of course, it overflowed from Harvey. This is not a pleasant subject, but what happens if waters fill with fecal material? Can you get cholera, which causes sometimes fatal vomiting and diarrhea? What about all the submerged cars? If people get cuts, will they get tetanus and possibly fatal breathing problems? Let's bring in Amish Adulja, an infectious disease expert and a senior associate at Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Dr. Adulja, start there.
Some of the water has sewage in it. Some of the water just has the normal microorganisms that live in water. You would expect to see an upswing in some of the diarrheal illnesses in this type of a setting.
You know, you have thousands of people in a convention center, for instance. If there is some sort of infectious diarrheal illness that spreads quickly, where do they literally go?
Yeah, it'll definitely be a hard problem to control the waste and do basic infection control and hygiene in these kind of settings where you've got a lot of people housed together with not a lot of personal space. And we've seen outbreaks like this in all kinds of mass gatherings or clustered populations. It's not just going to be GI viruses. You're also going to see respiratory viruses spread as people are unable to wash their hands or coughing and sneezing. Those types of infections also would be expected to occur in this setting.
Yeah. What about some of the concerns that people have of things like, you know, tetanus or cholera even?
Well, first, tetanus is something that you hear a lot about, and some of the risks are overblown. The people who need tetanus vaccines are those who are not immunized. If people have kept up with their boosters, they shouldn't really be at risk for tetanus. So that sometimes comes up in all of these disasters, and sometimes I think it's a little bit misplaced. With regard to cholera, cholera is a risk in certain areas. However, Texas doesn't have a major cholera problem. We have only a handful of cholera cases in the United States. Of course, there could be cholera in the Gulf water that people now are ingesting as that water makes it into their drinking supply. But I wouldn't put cholera at the top of my list. It's something that we should think about. But I do think more common things like E. coli, norovirus, rotavirus, even a little bit odd things like leptospirosis, which comes from rat urine.
Ooh.
Those are things that we really need to look for.
Leptospirosis, how do we look for that?
Well, so leptospirosis is a pathogen that is excreted in rat urine. And lots of urban rats have leptospirosis in their urine. And we see high levels of that, the antibodies to it in kids who live in urban areas. So you would expect with all of these rats running for their lives, just like humans are in this flood territory, there's going to be people exposed to rat urine. It may get into their mouth, it may get into their eyes, and then that bacteria can then transmit. And that can cause some severe infections, including some that are life-threatening.
And when you do stop and think about everything that's on the street, just on the ground, I mean, we walk dogs, there's all sorts of animals, outside. But then you also have cars. And then you also have that Houston is the center of the chemical industry in the United States. And Renee Funk, Associate Director for Emergency Management of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the number one thing they're worried about is chemicals from the plants, but also people's homes. If everybody thinks about what they have in their cleaning closet or what they have in their garage or their shed, and then you throw in that Houston or the region has 24 Superfund sites. The EPA calls some of the things that were in these Superfund programs legacy contamination. There's lead, arsenic. There's accounts of people in their neighborhood having a site for a factory that used to use creosote and other toxins, and they can see it. And so if they can see it when the waters rise, the waters, we're carrying it away. What does that do?
It's hard to say exactly what it will do because there's lots of different combinations, and a lot of it is going to also depend upon the concentration that someone is exposed to, because we know that if something is very diluted, it may not pose as much of a risk as if you're getting it in a fully concentrated form. The other thing is a lot of the danger may be from ingesting something. So if you swallow contaminated water that has toxic chemicals in it, you may develop symptoms, but also some can be absorbed through the skin. And it's really hard to make any kind of educated comments about it because we don't know exactly what the contents people are being exposed to are. Once you have that, then you can start to think about what the different toxidromes they may be experiencing would be. And I think that's why it's really important that people try and avoid the floodwaters, because not only are there infectious risks there, there are also toxic risks as well.
What else are you thinking about when it comes to health concerns?
One of the things that our group has studied is the effect that these types of natural disasters have on the healthcare sector. And we've already seen in this disaster multiple hospitals go under distress. We heard about Bentaub Hospital having a failed evacuation, Bentaub running out of food. We've heard about some of the cancer centers there having to cancel appointments and having to rearrange their schedule. So what I suspect is going to happen is for the months after this event has occurred, you're going to have basically a new normal in the healthcare sector where people are displaced from their usual place of care. Maybe their hospitals or services have been cut and they're going to be seeking care elsewhere. And that can cause what's called a surge situation at many other hospitals where they're going to be inundated with patients they may not know, who may have needs that their hospital doesn't have. That type of thing happened during Hurricane Sandy in New York and New Jersey, and I expect that's going to happen as well in Houston. I mean, the things that you don't think about are, for example, methadone clinics, and if people need to get their methadone prescription or they go to a certain dialysis clinic, which is now underwater or gone, where are they going to turn up and who knows their exact dialysis formula that they use? All of that needs to really be thought about, and that's why hospitals really, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina several years ago, really started thinking about emergency preparedness in a new way.
That's Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease expert and senior associate at Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Doctor, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, rat urine. Well, many Houstonians are getting their first chance to see what they've lost. Christopher Connolly of member station KERA spent some time with one family just starting.
Okay. Let's just put them outside for now and let's dry them. Like in front of the garage, behind. We'll stick them in front of the garage.
Christy Garcia spent the day overseeing a small army of family members, helping her sort through practically everything she owns. After the floods, every item that made this modest white two-bedroom into a home is now a decision. Is it salvageable or not?
The chairs, they're wood. We could let them dry out and take off the bottom and reimposter them if we can. Are you think I should throw them?
Just days ago, Garcia, her husband Raul, and her two grown children watched in horror as the floodwaters rose in this working-class neighborhood in East Houston. The family frantically moved their most precious items to the highest shelves. They put their nice couches on folding tables in hopes that they'd be spared, and then they waded into the street in search of higher ground. Trucks passed them by. One picked them up, but it got stuck in high water. In all, it took them 14 hours to reach the emergency shelter at the convention center downtown.
It's hard, but we're going to get through it. And that a lot of my neighbors had babies, kids. We need the help out here. They came late to help us.
Now the curb in front of Garcia's home is piling up with ruined carpet and soggy mattresses, waterlogged furniture, clothes, and bedding. It looks like this all up and down the street. Inside the house, family members use brooms to push the last stinking water out the back door. The Garcias managed to save their most important documents and family photos. Daughter Anna lost a guitar, but she saved two electric keyboards. Husband Raul's collection of die-cast metal cars is mostly unharmed. These are small but important victories. They stand in contrast to the incredible needs facing the Garcias and so many others in their neighborhood.
Beds, clothes, shoes. Because like you see, we threw everything. We just went with what we grabbed that day, and that was it.
More than anything, Garcia says rebuilding will take money. She's already applied for FEMA help and filed car and home insurance claims.
It's just rebuild and get everything fixed and hope for the best that everything comes out okay with the help that they said they're going to give us. Insurance-wise, FEMA, everything, that we will get the help. That they don't stall on us, that they'll help us.
And with that, Christy Garcia returns to the work at hand, sorting through the wreckage of a comfortable life that's barely recognizable after Harvey. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Houston.
Is it time to talk about the connection between Harvey and climate change? After all, a new analysis from the University of Wisconsin says Harvey is a 1-in-1,000-year flood event. Let's ask Carrie Emanuel. He's professor of atmospheric science at MIT. Professor, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And is there something about Harvey that we can attribute to climate change at this point?
Well, there are a couple of things. Its surge was a little bit higher simply because it was riding on top of an elevated sea level. Fortunately, the surge went into a very unpopulated part of Texas, so we don't hear much about it. The other thing is that the atmosphere is about 6% more humid than it would have been at that time of year at that place, say in 1980, because it's warmer. And those are the two things that we can be fairly certain about.
What about the fact that it stalled over Texas for so long?
Well, the fact that it stalled is really the reason why we had such a colossally unusual event. And it stalled because the steering winds gave out. They were forecast to. But what we don't know is whether this is something that we expect to see as a consequence of climate change going forward. We just haven't really done the research to figure that one out. It might have just been a random occurrence. It might have been made more or even less probable by climate change. These are questions we'd like to know the answers to.
When you look at this and put it together with some of the other superstorms that we've seen, it does feel like we're seeing a lot of 1 in 100 years or 1 in 500 year storms over and over again. Is that just a coincidence or is that climate change?
Well, there are two aspects to this. I mean, if you're living in Texas and your house is hit by a tornado, it's a 1 in a million year event. If somewhere else in Texas next year somebody else's house gets hit, that's a 1 in a million year event, so you've had 2 in a row. Well, that's just not thinking about it correctly. But let's be serious about this. We have seen a string of different records. For example, Typhoon Haiyan in 2013 and Eastern Pacific Patricia of 2015 both broke all-time records for the most intense tropical cyclones. Sandy was the largest in diameter ever observed in the North Atlantic. Katrina of 2005 had the largest surge ever recorded in the United States. And now we have Harvey with the largest rainfall ever recorded in a hurricane in the United States. So one begins to wonder, when you have these different metrics being broken all in the last few years, whether we're seeing something. Now, some of it is consistent with our expectations. We have long predicted that global warming would allow hurricanes to become more intense and their surges higher, and also long predicted that they would produce more rain.
Well, earlier this week, we spoke with Texas Congressman Pete Olson, who's a Republican, about his Houston area district, which is dealing with Harvey. And I asked him about something he had done just a few months ago. He had praised President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords. And we asked him if Harvey had changed his mind at all.
The strongest, worst hurricane to hit Texas happened in 1900. Galveston hurricane killed 8,000 people. But this is not the proper place to have the debate on climate change, Paris Accords. This right now, my only focus is Hurricane Harvey.
Okay, so understandable that his focus right now would be Hurricane Harvey. But what about that point that this is not the time to talk about climate change? What do you think we're losing by not having a debate about climate change when we see a huge storm like this?
Well, I think it's very natural whenever you have an extreme event, people want to know what caused it. And back in the 80s, any of these events would have been blamed on El Nino. So one has to be careful. You can't jump to the conclusion that's because of climate change. But on the other hand, you can't embrace the opposite fallacy that there's nothing to see here. As a scientist, you have to sort of look at the facts, try to understand how climate change is warping the probability of these events. The congressman mentioned the Galveston hurricane of 1900. It wasn't that extreme an event as far as you know, a natural phenomenon, but there was no warning of it. We didn't have good forecasts back right in those days, and that's why it killed so many people.
If we were having a debate about climate change right now because of what we've just seen with Harvey and some of the other major storms, what do you think we would be doing to prepare for future storms?
Well, my community of scientists who study the relationship between hurricanes and climate have been coming together with a consensus on a few things we know. There's a lot that we don't know, but one is that storms will rain a lot more as it gets warmer. The other is that surges will be larger because storms will get a bit more intense and because sea level's going up. So every community has to tackle this on its own because every community will be affected differently. So here in Boston, we're actually beginning to contemplate building a seawall across the inner part of Boston Harbor. In other places, it makes sense to talk about vertical evacuation, getting people up inside tall buildings. Every place has its own sort of optimal solution. The point is, we all, as communities, ought to be talking about this.
That's Carrie Emanuel, a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. Professor Emanuel, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
And send us your thoughts on this at hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.